We're going back to our study of Abraham in Genesis, and in today's chapters we had two choices, either the whole time on a funeral or a wedding. So I decided to look at the loss of Sarah and her funeral quickly, and be Genesis 23, and spend much more time on a wedding for Isaac. Because I thought fair to be happy, start out with positive and do marriage made in heaven rather than all for a funeral. And yet I didn't want to leave her funeral out totally, and I have seen the place on the news twice last month. So we'll begin and shortly look at Genesis 23, verse 1. Now Sarah lived 127 years. These were the years of life of Sarah. Sarah died in Kiriath Arba, that is Hebron, in the land of Canaan, and Abram went up to mourn for Sarah and to weep for her. Now, if you'll come to verse 19, he bought a cave. For this, Abraham buried Sarah, his wife, in the cave of Machpelah, facing Mamre, that is Hebron, in the land of Canaan. Well, before Christmas and New Year's messages, we were studying Genesis verse by verse, and at the section in Abraham, Isaac has already been born. That was chapter 21. Abraham would have offered him up on Mount Moriah in chapter 22, but God provided a sacrifice. And Mount Moriah ended up being the place where Solomon built his temple, and then later the same place of Herod's temple in the time of Jesus. So God provided a sacrifice for replacement of Isaac, and God provided sacrifices on that place over and over and over again. Animals temporarily kept off punishment until the real Lamb of God could come and make it permanent. And Mount Moriah is in Jerusalem. The Dome of the Rock is a rock that's there. The ark sat there. That's where Abraham would have offered up Isaac. Now, they had to go to Jerusalem for a trip, but they lived in around Hebron most of the time. And that's where Genesis 23 takes place. She died, lived a long time. One thing that's interesting about this is Abraham's supposed to get the land, but he doesn't own any. So God's promises took a long time. They were partially fulfilled in his lifetime. He did have a son, but they were not fully fulfilled in his lifetime. He did not have any descendants yet, certainly not as the stars, and he didn't own any land at all and had to go buy a burial plot. So that kind of shows that God will keep his promises, but he does it in his time. And sometimes with Abraham, it was slower than what one would have thought. Sometimes that can be the case with him. So we get to Genesis 23, and they lose her. But part of the reason I put this in at all is the cave of Machpelah is still there. And Herod, way back in Jesus' time, before Jesus' time by a little bit, built a monument there to Sarah. The walls of his monument, some of the lower walls are still there. They're built just like a temple. Later, they built a mosque over it in 1100. But Herod's lower walls are still there. And that was on the news recently a couple of times. Number one, I think it's kind of interesting, the Jews prayed for the American election there. And that was in November. I also saw on the news about Hebron that it is partly a mosque, partly a synagogue. And the building is still there, and it's partly one way, partly the other way, partly Friday, partly Saturday. And 10 times a year, they switch. All the synagogue, the whole building, all the mosque, the whole building. They're barely getting along. But that is the cave. And when the Jews, in the war of 1967, when they took over the place, they sent a really thin Israeli soldier lady down in there. And she went down in there. It is a cave. It is a burial place. There are people buried down there. Is it Abram and Sarah and Isaac and Rebecca and Jacob and Leah? Maybe. 100%, I don't know, but back in the days of Jesus, that's where they would have said it is. It's 2,000 years old where this cave is. So I didn't really want to leave that out because of that finding, but better on a marriage made in heaven. And if we'll come to Genesis 24 now, problem for me with Genesis 24, it's 67 verses to tell the story. So I will read a little bit of it, but other times I'll just have to tell the story. But let's begin in Genesis 24, 1 through 9. Now Abraham was old, advanced in age, and the Lord had blessed Abraham in every way. Abraham said to his servant, the oldest of his household, who had charge of all that he owned, please place your hand under my thigh, and I will make you swear by the Lord, the God of heaven and the God of earth, that you shall not take a wife for my son from the daughters of the Canaanites among whom I live, but you shall go to my country, to my relatives, and take a wife for my son Isaac. The servant said to him, suppose the woman will not be willing to follow me to this land. Should I take your son back to the land where you came from? Then Abraham said to him, beware that you do not take my son back there. The Lord, the God of heaven, who took me from my father's house and from the land of my birth, who spoke to me and swore to me, saying, to your descendants I will give this land. He will send his angel before you, and you will take a wife for my son. But if the woman is not willing to follow you there, then you shall be free from this my oath. Only do not take my son back there. The servant placed his hand over the thigh of Abraham, his master, and swore to him concerning this matter. Well, poor Isaac, he lost his mother, and he's still not married, and at his age, he's quite old for never having been married. The Bible doesn't say why Abraham waited. Could it have been a problem that he waited? Well, maybe, but more the stress is Abraham was cautious. You can tell that from what he said. And he's just cautious that the pagan women that are closer to him, they're not suitable. Kind of a best to wait. Don't be stampeded into a bad choice. Best to wait. And that's probably what Abraham's caution is all about. Now that he is the widower, though, he's starting to think. Time is moving on. And he's thinking about this plan. Just don't marry a pagan and don't bring him back to the old land. This strange custom, put your hand under my thigh. That makes no sense at all. What they usually think it is kind of like, if you don't keep this oath, may my descendants who come out of my body punish you. What they usually think this is all about. Kind of a ritual, you know, get down here on your knees, put your hand on my leg. If you don't do what you swear you're going to do, may my descendants who come out of my body, maybe they eventually will punish you. And we don't have time to talk too much about the servant, although a whole sermon could be made about the servant. Fascinating, because he's very, very unselfish. This could have been Eliezer, who had been the heir, if they had never had children. He could have been the one that inherited everything. And what he's doing here is he is doing the best to uplift the one who replaced him. Interesting psychology. It's kind of like John the Baptist about Jesus. He must increase, but I must decrease. And we can't speak a whole sermon about, probably his name is Eliezer, but amazing psychology. I'm going to get nothing. I will do what I can to exalt the person who replaced me. Wow. I think God will take care of him. It's like Jesus said to the apostles that anybody who gives up houses and lands for me will get 100 times more in heaven. He wanted to do God's will. Even if God's will met, he would get less attention. And not the inheritance at all. We see Abraham's faith here. Abraham is pretty sure this will work. I think we should interpret verse 7 as very strong. He will send his angel before you. But just in case you're worried, don't worry about it if she doesn't want to come. The unselfish servant accepts God's plan, and now he will give a prayer to find Mrs. Wright. And they start off, let's read verse 10 and following. The servant took 10 camels from the camels of his master and set out with a variety of good things of his master's in his hand. And he arose and went to Mesopotamia, the middle of the rivers, Mesopotamus rivers in the city of Nahor. He made the camels kneel down outside the city by a well of water evening time, a time when women go out to draw water. And he said, O Lord, the God of my master Abraham, please grant me success today and show loving kindness, chesed, to my master Abraham. Behold, I am standing by the spring, and the daughters of the men of the city are coming out to draw water. May it be that the girl to whom you say, please let down your jar so that I may drink, and who answers, drink, and I will water your camels also. May she be the one whom you have appointed for your servant Isaac. And by this, I shall know that you have shown your loyal love, loving kindness to my master. It came about before he had finished speaking that, behold, Rebekah, who was born to Bethuel, the son of Milcah, the wife of Abraham's brother Nahor, came out with a jar on her shoulder. And the girl was a very beautiful virgin, and no man had known her, had relations with her. And she went down to the spring and filled up her jar and came up. Then a servant ran to meet her and said, please let me drink a little water from your jar. She said, drink, my lord. And she quickly lowered the jar to her hand and gave him a drink. But now when she had finished giving him a drink, she said, I will draw also for your camels until they have finished drinking. So she quickly emptied her jar into the trough and ran back to the well to draw, and she drew for all his camels. Meanwhile, the man was gazing at her in silence to know whether the Lord had made his journey successful or not. Then it came about when the camels had finished drinking that the man took a gold ring weighing half a shekel and two bracelets for her wrist wearing 10 shekels in gold and said, whose daughter are you? Please tell me there is room for us to lodge in your father's house. She said, I am the daughter of Bethuel, the son of Milcah, that's the mother, whom she bore to Nahor. And she said to him, we have plenty of both straw and feed and room to lodge in. Then the man bowed low and worshipped the Lord. And he said, blessed be the Lord, God of my master Abraham, who has not forsaken his loving kindness and his truth towards my master. As for me, the Lord has guided me in the way to the house of my master's brothers. Well, 10 camels and 500 miles, 500 miles each way. Nice and slow. I bet they really were thirsty. Camels in Genesis always comes up. It used to be the liberals will say that they did not have any domesticated camels at the time of Abraham, so this must be untrue. They have since found camel bones in a house in Turkey. The Hittites would put, we call it a garage, to put the camels over there. They found camel bones in the house, and they did domesticate camels. But the reason I said this is it's very, very common for Bible critics to attack the Bible very severely and not know anything, and later it comes out they were wrong all the time. There's quite a few cases of that, and that needs to be remembered whenever we hear about someone attacking the Bible. And the one here was... They didn't use camels at that time, though they certainly did. Eliezer was probably Eliezer, the older servant who had been the heir. Thinks if he goes out to the city well, he will meet some strangers and meet some girls. Often women got to carry the water back home, and you know, we do 5-gallon jugs, and they're 40 to 42 pounds, and I do 2 of them, and that's about all I want to do. And I just take them from the trunk into the house. And in those days, the girls would have to go outside the city limits and go out to the well and get these big jugs and carry them back. They're probably doing it every day. Hard working. And he's going to make a test for hardworking and unselfish. So he prayed that the woman that he meets that might be the appointed one, he will offer the people water. And there was more than just a servant. There were a train of them coming along, a caravan. So, but also water the 10 camels. So, I think probably since Jesus said you should not put God to the test, maybe tests are before the Bible was written, and I think we know what God wants us to do from the Bible firstly, and then after that, I think he does lead us with promptings and impressions. I don't know about a test, but this is no Bible yet, Old Testament times, here's a test. And at least it would show someone who, A, works hard, and B, is very unselfish. That aspect of the test would be quite true. There is in here his belief that God guides in the way, and his belief that God has appointed someone for Isaac to marry. So that will be repeated over and over again. Several references to loving kindness. I mentioned the Hebrew there. All these words in Hebrew are fascinating. They're a little bit different in English. They're translated right, but loving kindness means loyal love. And the way we would say it now, I think, to communicate again is God will not break up. And his loving kindness is true with keeping his promise to save all who trust his son. He will not break up his relationship. So we often think of that as marriage. He will not break up. But God's number one Old Testament characteristic is loyal love. He won't dump anybody who believes in his son as Savior. Theologically, it said in verse 16, Rebecca was a Bethuel, a virgin, literally a virgin. Later, we can't read it all, but later in verse 43, she will be a young maiden, an Alma. Of course, unmarried women often ought to be virgins. That's the way it should be. And Rebecca was both. This text always comes up in studies of Isaiah 7:14. Behold, an Alma will conceive and bear a son. Okay, a young maiden will conceive and bear a son. Does it have to be translated virgin? I think so, in the promise made to King Ahaz. I will show you a sign as high as heaven, as deep as Sheol. It has to be something fascinating. It can't be ordinary. This unmarried woman gets married and has a baby. It has to be something as high as heaven or deep as Sheol. And a maiden can be a virgin, and always in these studies, in comes Genesis 24. She is unmarried and literally a virgin. It comes into every study of Isaiah 7:14. She was good-looking. Being old or getting there, I always think of the servant runs to her and she doesn't run off, because if I ran to anybody, they'd get their cell phone out and call 911. And you can't even hardly talk with the younger mothers at the school playground when the kids get out of school now, because that's going to be kind of a result of COVID and also a result of all the crime around us. It's getting, people are less friendly. Harder to try to introduce to strangers. I've always considered that part of what I'm trying to do with ministry, so I do try to talk with strangers. It's getting worse. And everybody knows it. We'll see what happens. But he runs towards her, and she stands there. And we always think of the earlier days as more violent, and I don't know. The psychology is getting weird. He runs. She stands there. Get a drink. She gives him a drink. Waters all the camels, and then there's this big tip. We don't know whether it's 24 karat, probably not, probably mixed with something else, but my goodness, 5 ounces of gold, $5,000 to $10,000. Here's your tip. Thanks for the water. His way of also introducing where he's come from, and he thanks God again that God has guided him. That's verse 7, verse 27. There's going to be two more. Four times in here, whether we can read them all. The angel went before me, and God has guided me in the way. Four times in here. It looks like success, but he doesn't really know for certain yet. She runs off, and this is verse 28. She goes to her mother. I thought that was interesting. Didn't go to dad. Goes to her mother. It could be, now dad's still alive because he's mentioned here in verse 50, but it could be he's kind of what we would say is retired. Because the older brother makes all the introductions and he makes all the decisions. Yes, they can stay here. So she goes to her mother's household, which means she went to her older brother also. Dad might be getting more inactive. And in this story that we don't have time to read at all, he tells her about the family back in Israel, make sure they're related. And again, in verse 40, he repeats that God sent his angel before him. And in verse 44, for example, he gives the test. Let the one that waters of people and camels be the appointed one. And in verse 48 again, this is the fourth time the Lord guided me on this trip. And we'll read a little bit more as we go on. One wonders, did she have any say in it? Not 100% certain, but it looks like it. Because the right away the servant says, if she will not come back, am I out of this oath? If she chooses not to come back, am I out of this oath? And later they're going to ask her what she wants to do. Now, you could say they were only asking her whether she wants to go right now or wait 10 days. But I think it's probably better to interpret it. Older brother and dad do have to give blessing, but ultimately it's her choice. Now, we see from British books and British movies about all these arranged marriages, and there are people that want to get married, and they make the lady get married, and I don't know what they did in every family, but it sounds like here it's going to be her choice. Let's read in verse 50 through 60 where they give her the choice. And Laban and Bethuel answered and said, the matter comes from the Lord, so he cannot speak to you good or bad. Here is Rebekah before you. Take her and go. Let her be the wife of your master's son as the Lord has spoken. Then he gives them gifts also and spend the night. And the part in here that we don't have time to read is they ask her, but then you wonder whether they ask her, do you want to go now or do you want to wait 10 days? But I think she has the final decision. That seems to be the servant's thought from the beginning. And here now again, I think it's more than do you want to go now or wait 10 days. I think it's a matter of do you want to go at all. The main application here is the servant didn't know whether they would follow God's plan, but the servant really believed that there is an appointed one. Genesis 24:44, there is the appointed one. There's a halfway New Year sermon here in that the angel guides me and I being in the way the Lord led me. And we can apply it in general to God guiding. Is there appointed for marriages? Well, I have always thought so. And that's why we pick Proverbs 19:14. House and wealth are inheritance from fathers, but a prudent wife is from the Lord. And in God's will in general, there's quite a few verses about, the Lord guided me. I have the references written here, but we'll just read Proverbs 16. A man plans his way, but the Lord directs his steps. So I think Genesis 24 does teach there is a planned person, when it's the right time to be married and the right plan for these people to be married. I always have the thought, what about people who have been divorced and what about things that aren't working out real right because the time we got married, we didn't believe any of this. Well, I would add this, that God is smart enough to fix everything. So what we might call his alternate plan will still lead to blessing. So all kinds of categories of the people here. Is there a Mrs. Wright and Mr. Wright? I think it teaches that. What if we didn't believe in God in the past or didn't care anything about his will? Well, God is so smart, he can fix it now. And I would look at it that way. He can still fix it and still bring a great blessing. Related verses, Proverbs 18:22, he who finds a wife finds a good thing and obtains favor from the Lord. Proverbs 12, verse 4, an excellent wife is the crown of her husband. So probably could have made a New Year's sermon out of it. You know, God guides and angel of the Lord leads and that sort of thing. Although maybe better a wedding sermon, wedding thoughts. She agreed to go. And in the last few verses of the chapter, she gets up and goes. Let's look at verse 61. Then Rebekah arose with her maids, and they mounted the camels and followed the man. So the servant took Rebekah and departed. Now it came about when, now Isaac had come from going to Beer, that means well, the one who sees me, he's watching, for he was living in the Negev. Isaac went out to meditate in the field toward evening, lifted up his eyes, and looked, and behold, camels were coming. Rebekah lifted up her eyes, and when she saw Isaac, she dismounted from the camel. She said to the servant, who is that man walking in the field to meet us? And the servant said, he is my master. She then took her veil and covered herself. The servant told Isaac all things that had been done. Then Isaac brought her into his mother Sarah's tent, and he took Rebekah. She became his wife, and he loved her. Thus Isaac was comforted after his mother's death. So he's out in the field. I don't think he knows what day they're coming back. He's out there thinking about things. I would think he's a little bit miserable because of the last line. He's out comforted. He was discomforted because his mother died. He's out in the field. He doesn't know what day they're coming. He's kind of hoping that it'll work out, but he may not know because, you know, the servant went off. Is anybody going to agree to this? Is anybody going to come back? She had agreed with it, and I do believe she's giving up her family, her homeland, and her pagan religion. Because all three here, you're not supposed to marry a pagan Canaanite, Isaac. Not supposed to marry someone who is an unbeliever. And I think that when she was leaving her home, I think her mom and dad and brothers and all them were idol worshippers. It says in Joshua 24 that Abraham left a land of idol worshippers. And they're sort of nice to Abraham and his religion with Yahweh. They're sort of nice to him, and they don't fight back or make fun of it, but I think she's leaving her religion. Some parallels with Ruth, in the book of Ruth. Leaving her family, leaving her homeland, leaving her false gods, and coming. Now, one last thought, which is, what kind of wedding is this? Came home, here's a tent. Get married. Makes us think about what is it that makes a marriage? I would have to go beyond Genesis 24 for what is it that makes a marriage, and the answer is basically the covenant. It says that in Proverbs 2 and Malachi 4, where God is a witness between you and the wife of your youth and the marriage of your covenant. Come with me, promise. In a wedding, we would say vows. Now, we should get a marriage license as long as they're one man and one woman for permanency. As long as the marriage license fits the Bible, I can see some that don't. I can foresee it. And I also, when I lived in Pennsylvania, there was a congressman who wanted to make marriage licenses like fishing licenses, and they last for 3 years, and you got to renew it. It was a long time ago. He didn't get elected, by the way. He lost that election. It was on the news. Get a license. It's supposed to obey the government, and as long as the license kind of fits the Bible's pattern, okay. But what is it that makes a wedding in God's sight? Jesus says, what God has joined together, let no man put asunder. So God does it. And in the Proverbs and Malachi, if you go beyond here, it's God is a witness of the promises. The promises to be with each other and to be with each other for a lifetime. So God makes weddings. Government, okay, you know, do what the government says, as long as it's a Christian marriage arrangement. Get a license, but it's the vows that make the wedding. It's interesting. God's main characteristic is the characteristic that makes a good marriage, and God's main characteristic is what starts the marriage. Making a covenant, a promise, a vow, keeping it. Well, I'm kind of glad we did a wedding sermon rather than all Sarah's funeral sermons. And let's have the choir come and we'll sing before communion.